Bach is someone that I personally, and I think most jazz people, hold in awe because
yeah.
He's an interesting guy, though. He's a funny guy.
Yeah. Ed Clay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he, okay, it's,
28th?
August 28th. It's Tony Payne and Barra and Louis Messiah. We're going to be talking about Oscar Michaud, his career, some aspects of the aesthetics of Black cinema, and deal a little bit with some actual films for Oscar Michaud. Let's start off by talking about the question of aesthetics and continuity. Do you think there is any you think there is a Black aesthetic that seems to emerge out of this early Black cinema, that there's any continuity in terms of the then and the now?
My difficulty, of course, is that the body of films of race films that I saw that were done in the 20s and 30s, and I'm seeing them in the 40s as a child, my concerns weren't aesthetic. And those that I've seen since, I haven't seen enough of them. Enough of a body.
Do you think that the films were just like Hollywood, or were they different, or what was special about them?
Distinctly different.
Yeah, it's hard for me as well to start off with aesthetics, because it really is subject that first
distinguishes them.
Right, first distinguishes the work. I mean, the sense of peril that's often there. That there's a sense of danger that's related to race, and then, you know, the themes that, and I'm not talking about comedies per se, but I'm talking more in sort of some of the Michaud dramas, then the themes that, in some ways I think that they're particular to Michaud, but because Michaud is so much of my knowledge of sort of like race films, you know, Black films, at that time, that I sort of assume that that's also what was in the consciousness, because it's also in the in some of the literature.
Mm-hmm. So would that address style and not aesthetic?
More subject, you know, more content. The aesthetic, it's really hard. It's hard for me to separate the aesthetic from European American films. Some of it, I mean, but it's the subject that distinguishes itself for me.
Mm. But the subjects don't necessarily distinguish themselves from Hollywood. It's the approach to the subject. I mean, if you take a Hollywood film that deals with the tragic mulatto, or just a mulatto figure, how does Michaud deal differently with that?
Well, I don't know if they're I don't feel that the tragic mulatto is, to me, really a Hollywood construct.
Okay.
Race, you know, color consciousness is not, you know, I mean, the mulattoes are not necessarily tragic in and of themselves. They have their own baggage, but there isn't that, mulatto does not equal death or sadness in the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's a character with behavior,
right,
and motives.
It's
a character with behavior and motives in Michaud. It's not an icon, and it's certainly not tragic. Right. Well, necessarily.
Could you be a little more specific?
I think that's true of all the of particular characters and particular subjects. Although, I think we would be hard pressed to come up with Euro-American films of the same period that handle questions of, of course they do, of rape, of lynching, incest, rape, color caste, interracial banditry, economic crimes that are the motives for things like lynching. It is the selection of subject, and in Michel, the persistence of certain kinds of themes, also the approach that distinguishes him from Warner Brothers, which is the only group of films that I can speak intelligently of that's going on in the industry in that period, in that same period.
Do you think that if you focus on the subject matter, which makes the difference, and that subject matter is embedded in the African-American experience, that do you think that lends itself to a kind of uniqueness, which perhaps aesthetic is not the right word, but it is an extension and an expression of the cultural experience, which is unique to?
Well, one of the yes and no, here's the no. The wimpy romances that we get in Michel, and we get in all of, in many of those films of the 30s that came out of Philadelphia, the wimpy romances that have a cultured, refined hero who listens to Bach or plays the violin, or at least wears a suit and a tie, and has very slick back hair and always works in an office. The heroine, who's a damsel in distress, we don't even question her sense of autonomy, generally. That's generally the kind of women we see in, maybe she's of a different caste than the refined cultured hero who rescues her. It's other things that are going on in the movie that have a fix in, that are in the script, I assume, because they do validate and reflect experiences of that period. But that's not true, I think, of the romance, particularly. They always seem wimpy and bougie.
So the construct of the melodrama is the same as mainstream cinema.
Well, I guess the difference might be for me. I mean, I think the construct of melodrama may be similar, but in actual acting styles within the melodrama, I think there's a little bit more space within the Michaud than any sort of miscellaneous black role in Hollywood. I mean, you know, the Michaud character may, you know, we talked earlier about the sort of mission and, you know, the sort of driven by sort of sometimes singular sort of obsessions, but still they're not stereotypical. I mean, there may be types, like the guy who's in both...
E.G. Tatum.
Yeah, right, who's both in Symbol of the Unconquered and Within Our Gate, who's a type, but it's not necessarily a stereotype.
Would you say that Michaud is not concerned with sort of negative and positive images, but projecting somehow another multi-layered character? I mean, it's not a pure stereotype.
Right, it's not a...
if it isn't a stereotype, then what is it?
A stock type.
Stock type. Stock type might be a better word. I don't know. I again, I mean, I really have to make these qualifications. I don't know enough of Michaud's work to say, you know, that, you know, throughout, you know, the mm-hmm. range of it, it's true. But it seems to me that the characters I'm drifting. It seems to me that the characters are they're not stereotypical. They're not negative, limited stereotypes. They really have room to develop somewhat within that. And it's a singular development, but they have room to develop from beginning to end. And also, just because they're more involved in plot, we get mm-hmm. to see them over time, as opposed to, you know, just a very kind of small mm-hmm. window.
Do you think these stories relate to the Black experience of that period in a way that directly spoke to the audience,
in
the intended audience?
Mm-hmm. I think in that period that blues music spoke directly to people's experience. And my evidence for that is that people used it. People use the songs. They use the songs to iron by, mm-hmm. or they use the songs to talk to each other. I think the music, more than the books, spoke to the experience. I think magazines, rather than books, mm-hmm. spoke to the experience.
Poetry.
The poetry was used. It was recited in church. It was recited in school. It was recited at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry had a vitality. That was also true of dance. I think it's less true of books. And I think it is, depends on what films we're talking about. I think it's less true of the films, but I think our standards, we use a different standard for the film and theater. That is to say, the theater of that period that people, I'm talking about the 20s and 30s, that people talk about in their diaries and in their letters were dramas that spoke to the issue of lynchings, campaigns against syphilis, or the situation of orphans and foster children, issues. They had, and there were other plays that spoke to, that were heroic, on Dessalines, Toussaint. There were those kind of pageants.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other kinds of plays that one went to because you were intelligent and cultured, and maybe you were a school teacher. I'm a little pressed as to what those plays might be. But they did not speak directly, nor did you demand that they speak directly to your everyday, ordinary experience. In like manner, I think the movies, we ask something slightly different of them. And I think Michaud, certainly in Within Our Gates, tries to deliver on both things. I'll just mention two things rather than get into a bunch. There is the social conscious piece, the socially responsible cinema piece, in that film recodes Breath of a Nation. It sets the record straight as to who raped who, etc. And then there's this melodrama, romance piece that is always very interesting, particularly in Michaud, but I think it's kind of true in the other films I'm thinking of, which is Scar of Shame and 11 to Midnight, things like that, where there's a lot of backstory, and the characters didn't just happen. They're not stockpipes in that way. Their history is particular, and we'll get it in backstory rather than their history comes from other appearances and other kinds of genres. So he tries to go level.
What do you mean by backstories?
We get, for example, in Within Our Gates, it's the backstory that's the real meat of the movie. When we get the backstory of Caspar Landry's daughter, her backstory consists of several things. One, her education. And that allows Michaud to talk about issues of the day, namely the urgency of saving the black land-grant colleges, for example, which is one of his concerns. also part of her backstory is that she was trained as a bookkeeper, and then that helps in the plot because she finds that Mr. Girdlestone, the white plantation owner, is trying to cook the books. Also part of her backstory is that she's not the daughter, or may not be the daughter of her foster parents, the Lantrys. And what's particular about, what's sort of one of the many characteristics of Michaud, what few films I've seen, is that the characters have a lot of backstory. They don't just pop on the screen. You think you know them in that they're familiar types, but their backstory fills in plot and it fills in more than plot. It helps to answer a lot of questions for the audience about, it makes a connection to, what am I trying to say, social reality.
Right. I mean, as we were looking at the Symbol of the Unconquered today, I was just thinking that there is an extraordinary amount of exposition here. I mean, like, it's, there was the action in the first scene of the father dying, and then it was, then the next sort of vague kind of dramatic scene was the mother, seeing the son, who's passing for white,
Driscoll,
courting the white woman, and Driscoll sort of ashamed that his black mother is approaching and choking her. But beyond that, there was a great deal of talking and background information sort of going on, and it just seemed to me that by our standards now of what drama is, there's so much filling in the past, and it does seem that I keep thinking about producers today, white executive producers today, when often in working with black filmmakers, are annoyed that there's this need to not just take things and looking at a specific incident related to today, rather than looking at that specific incident, not understanding why filmmakers want to go back and sort of go back to Africa to look at 1992. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's that same feeling of always needing to contextualize and create our own sense of how the history and the characters develop. And maybe that's why all that exposition is there. Although it's interesting. I mean, but it goes against a sort of action, dramatic,
trajectory.
Yeah, trajectory, which maybe a difference between Euro and African American film of that period.
Would you? How would you define that distinctiveness? That I want to use the word Afrocentricity.
Maybe the need to fully contextualize characters so that the character played by André Chenault is not just a colored man passing for white, but there's this long history, or the daughter, the granddaughter's not, you get a sense of where she came from, and that has as much to do with how the actions play out as the specifics of what's happening in that time.
Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't describe that as something that was unique to...
Again, I mean, in all honesty, Pearl, I don't know if I've seen enough films to say that, but certainly in looking at, definitely within our gate and with this film, there's this feeling that there's an extraordinary amount of exposition or recontextualizing. And it's not uninteresting, which is, I know in drama classes or in filmmaking classes, they say, it's too much time with your exposition, but it is interesting to me. So I don't know, maybe that is an Afrocentric approach.
Is that something you would describe as something that has sort of transcended the time, that is a kind of legacy of Michaud? I mean, would you equate
that? Is a characteristic of the films now? Yeah. I think one of the ways One of the characteristics of, say, independent black film in this country, I'm thinking particularly of what we used to call the Watts films, and the ones that have come after that, is, again, the necessity of a context. Nothing happens in a vacuum, and nothing happens with reference to some other movie, but rather in connection with social reality. And I think one of the ways in which it is transmitted or gotten over is not necessarily through backstory, but rather in the handling of space. For example, in industry films, you either get idealized space, as in the Westerns, or you get hidden space, as in the dramas. That is to say, the camera establishes what block we're in, usually what class, what city we're in, and what class the players belong to or have an affinity to, and then everything closes down. And with the use of window frames and door frames and camera close-ups, we reduce everything to the psychological. All conflict is psychological, not systemic. Therefore, all resolutions can be resolved by a shrink, a lawyer, or a bullet, but not, say, by societal transformation. In African cinema, we're especially aware of characters in their circumstances. So you get a different kind of shot and a different sense of space. In Daughters of the Dust, for example, and I think it's a very African handling of space, no character is background to any other. We don't get a foregrounded hero dominating space and everybody else being othered in the background or having their elbows sort of fall out of the frame or being in a blur. We get shared space, and the camera opens up so that we can get the collective point of view.
The focus is on
the
community.
The focus is also on social space, as opposed to it's social space and it's shared space and it's democratic space, as opposed to idealized space, hierarchical space dominated by one hero, kind of thing. And if I haven't looked at this question, but now that you raise it, it's interesting. But I think it's more the handling of space, the way we handle space, that allows us to make that connection, ask the spectator to make that connection between this story and contiguous reality.
So, yeah, it's going along with that. I mean, as you were talking, Tony, I was thinking that this notion of exposition is really going against the sort of relentless pushing forward of narrative. I mean, and when I think of in some of Burnett's work, you know, My Brother's Wedding or Killer of Sheep, that social space, the interaction and the way of relating is so much of the beauty of the story. I mean,
yeah.
It's not actually, you know, plot going from A to B to C to D, although that's there, but it's really how
we get there.
How we get there. Even, you know, She's Got a Habit. I mean, it's not, you know, the actual narrative is not all that wonderful. But I think what made that film so noticeable was the interrelations of characters, how they, not necessarily things that were pushing story forward, but things that sort of established who those characters were, getting a better sense of
playing against each other,
right, and setting up, you know,
who are we?
Who are we? I mean, any story could do in some ways, as long as we get to know who we are in the process.
How does one get to know who we are in this, thinking again about these early films of the 20s, Oscar Michelle and others, how does one get to know who we are within the context of the films? Is there some kind of common expression, some common ground that the filmmakers use to get at that idea of who we are? If you use the term of the period, racial uplift,
mm-hmm.
As an operative,
mm-hmm.
how does Michaud get to that racial uplift in his films?
Let's see. That's the question I would raise with to you, Pearl.
Well, did you think about it in terms of within our gates? I mean, there is a racial uplift theme in the backstory there.
I think there are, you know, two ways. I mean, certainly by looking at, you know, presenting the history, breaking out from the false view of history that
yes.
is this false view of the Klan and raping and lynching, you know, what that was about, instead of saying, okay, no, we're not going to go with, you know, that version. We're going to go with, you know, a true version. Same for, you know, when I think now what Michaud is saying about the Klan in Symbol is he's saying that terrorism is about economic. The roots are economic. It's not even vaguely racial. You know, it's really about economic subjugation.
That's in Symbol of the Unconquered.
Right.
The white capping is used by an interracial group.
Right.
Blacks
right.
and whites against.
As a means of control and you know, that, economic, you know,
yeah.
oppression.
You were going to say there's another way. You said there were two ways of the racial uplift. I'm looking at something else.
I think. Well, sorry.
I think he gets through with this quest theme that forever pops up, that people are not miscellaneous,
mm-hmm.
they're not meandering about, they're not simply encountering each other out of the melodramatic wimpy romance thing. Everybody has an agenda. I mean, his major players have an agenda,
mm-hmm.
both, you know, good guys and seemingly not so good guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at Exile, looking at Buddy, and so let me just stick to these two. The quest, yeah, there's always an economic, he's always got an economic argument going on here.
Mm-hmm.
People are after land. Let me look at Within Our Gates, because that's a lot less ambiguous. One of the quests that's we can read in the exegesis of the film, but it's also it's an internal and outside of the text is this education, the necessity for black folk to take responsibility for an Afrocentric, if you will, curriculum for autonomy and education, for self-determination and education. That's one of the quests of the hero, I
mm-hmm.
think.
In this case, it's the heroine.
Well, it's both.
Well.
Is the hero that a doctor or something?
The doctor.
He's a doctor,
and he's
frequently reading the newspaper
mm-hmm.
about. He keeps track of the education. He's very concerned there. And then she, of course,
mm-hmm.
is actively engaged in the Pine School. The Piney Woods
right.
School.
Which was actually a school.
Yeah, the Piney Woods still. Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
Lynn Watley's, the Watley family
mm-hmm.
school. And that is that, it is her quest for education that propels the plot. She will now go out and look for money
mm-hmm.
in order to fund the school.
Certainly the very characters. I mean, seeing those characters on the screen, you know, in the climate of, you know, what black characters may have been in Hollywood films. That in and of itself had to be up there.
Yeah.
You know, to confirm the existence of a diverse and caring and committed African American community.
How important or deliberate do you think Michaud's use of, I want to say actuality, but that's perhaps not the right word, but in this instance of the Pinewood School, for instance, or after opening a story, placing it in the context of Tuskegee mm-hmm. or Hampton Institute, how...
I think that's I think that is very characteristic of black people. I think that is characteristic even of our science fiction writers and even of our so-called magic realism writers. There is no need or no desire to ever depart so much from base reality or actual. There's just that impulse is not there. The impulse, rather, I think, is to illuminate what is happening in actuality and to hook it. You find those hooks in Sam Delaney. I know I could get into a huge argument with somebody. So yes, we will see Booker T. Washington. We will hear about the Pineywood School, which is actual. We will in within our gates. We will see when the Dr. Hero looks at. The newspapers, we see actual clippings mm-hmm. that were familiar to people of that period as documented in the diaries of Alice Dunbar Nelson and others who kept journals in symbol of the unconquered, what is it in symbol of the unconquered? Pearl.
The getting back to the land? As a
No, there's some other actual. Oh, the prospector? Was it the guy, Mason?
The
someone named
and
Mason,
prospector.
Who found, who discovered oil. Mm. I think it's not only shrewd to do it. I think that's a very basic impulse. And I think it only becomes questionable when we're looking at some other standard. It's very characteristic of, black people in novels are constantly tipping their hats to actual characters and to events. At the moment, I was Beloved crossed my mind. Toni Morrison's Beloved crossed my mind for a moment.
Du Bois and Mansart builds a school. pulls in Booker T. Washington.
In that novel.
But in film and cinema, it's an experience. In a group situation, unlike reading a novel.
Well, it's also like seeing those. Who has the Jesus pictures?
Spencer Williams.
Yeah, I mean, like seeing Jesus in some ways in a film is reality. It's sort of like it's a similar kind of thing.
Yes.
It's not just seeing the Jesus figure so much as it is seeing the style of the way in which the religion is practiced.
It's
baptismal,
cultural specific
and familiar. That's the
it's
word.
That I remember when Hallelujah. Is it in Hallelujah? Yeah, in Hallelujah. There was I can't think of his name. The brother who was the consultant to Vidor, and there are these scenes of ecstatic religion. The not only the baptisms, but I don't know what to call those moments. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say possession of getting happy, getting the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And people, who's telling me this? I guess my grandmother's telling me this. The people, folks, went to see the film time and time and time again just for those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was validation.
They were real.
They were
mm-hmm.
real.
Mm-hmm.
They were real. So they validate the experience and they reflect the experience. They mostly validate the experience. What is that, 1927, I guess, 29?
Well, 29. Hallelujah, it's 1929.
Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm going away from the sort of aesthetics and content for a second. I mean, one of the reasons I'm most interested in Michaud is, and I hate to just, using the word businessman sort of mm-hmm. limits him, mm-hmm. but really in the context of being trying to be self-sufficient, although he never really totally managed to do that, but working within this United States society as an African-American, working specifically in the African-American community, and continuing, for decades, that to me is
it's a usable model.
Very usable model, and certainly it's really in that role that I sort of see him. Even, I mean, the filmmaking is what he did, but you know, this is the particulars of his craft, but that kind of self-sufficiency and
persistence.
And then
these ploys, as I would argue again that the use of actuality is not only just characteristic and impulse,
mm-hmm.
but I think is also shrewd to do. It makes it timely, and I think that is also very, well, I guess I'm saying the same thing, very characteristic of black art practice,
mm-hmm.
to not be concerned about immortality, but to comment on, to be timely,
mm-hmm.
To be of use and of service immediately to the community. And Michaud's use of incidents, his use frequently in films, I'm more concerned trying to read the you know, what pharmacy is that in the background, and the fact that it comes through so clearly indicates that he wants us to know that that's that particular pharmacy, because maybe that pharmacist helped bankroll this film, and maybe that's where his last film was seen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very shrewd and useful. The way in which he dismantled or recycled films,
mm-hmm.
Made use of people who were in town. Who was, I'm trying to think of who, I can't remember what film, well, of course, what do I have to wonder? Girl is sitting right here. Films that have inserts from, I'll make it up because I can't think of it, but from the Cotton Club, or there's a choir in town, and he'll use some of that footage.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're in that choir, how can you not go see the film?
Mm-hmm.
There's another operative there that's very interesting about Michaud's work and the way he made the little bit of money that he had work for him. And one of it is the way in which he was able to capture his audience. If he put out a call for people to appear at a certain nightclub because he was going to be shooting
mm-hmm.
in that space, and the people would arrive, they could then return to see the finished film, which would indeed play
mm-hmm.
in town, and not only was the club identified, but
uh-huh.
one could see
oneself.
Your next-door neighbor or oneself
right.
in the movies.
And you could tell
you were part of the right, part of the whole glamorous
mm-hmm.
facade and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something that is always a kind of begging question in my mind about Michaud's work, and that is that not just the impulse for racial uplift, but his seeming need to correct, to be the moralist on one level, but always trying to redirect and reconstruct not just the image
mm.
on film, but the image that was operative within the community,
mm-hmm.
and trying to correct those images. In one of his novels, he makes a statement about one of his greatest goals is to prove to a certain group of my acquaintances, meaning race people, blonde people,
mm-hmm.
that a man can be anybody. He can be anything. Right? He only needs to throw himself into and sort of achieve. So that, and that's a kind of a theme that seems to pervade
mm-hmm.
many of Michaud's films, that will to succeed, the need to succeed, the role model
mm-hmm.
Himself is always, Michaud himself is always a part of that story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the prospector.
The homesteader.
He's the homesteader.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's the book salesman.
Yes.
He's the producer in Swing.
Right.
And so on. So that there is this need for corrective and kind of directive
mm-hmm.
impetus
mm-hmm.
to his films within the framework of these typical Hollywood genres. Not Hollywood, maybe the typical entertainment mode.
Mm-hmm.
He still
mm-hmm.
you know,
gets
pushes
away.
In that kind of corrective and directive elements. You're nodding your head.
I'm looking at literature, I'm looking at film, I'm looking at songs, I'm looking at what comes to mind, of course, is that, well, not of course, a slew of songs that have a fairly Tin Pan Alley outline, that manage to get a whole lot said, or the way in, that impulse that we had, particularly in the same 20s, of taking a sonnet or some other usual form and making it work. Stretching its productivity, testing its productivity. Can a sonnet incorporate and accommodate a lynching, a protest statement about lynching, which is, of course, what Claude McKay does with If We Must Die. Yeah. But I was looking at songs, too. When Nina Simone in the 60s announces as she sits down to play Mississippi Goddamn, this is a show tune, I haven't written the show yet, and gives us that very jumpy, corny, totally predictable, music, you know, oh papa, kind of, couldn't be cornier, to give us Mississippi Goddamn. It's absolutely in the tradition of improvisation, of making you, of recycling, making you, it's George Washington Carver.
And I'm going to make it work
exactly.
for me.
Right. It's George Washington Carver. Here's this lovely peanut, watch me. You know,
So you think that's operative in the movies? In Michelle's movies.
You were just telling us. I think it's characteristic.
Can you think of any other aspect of, looking at Michelle's work, and our reason for looking at Michelle and not at a number of other people's, because he of all of the race movie makers, the African-American movie makers, was the most productive, and so more of his work seems to have survived. And he was perhaps the most contentious of the lot, so that things are a little more obvious in terms of his drive and motivation. But those things that are characteristic of a Michaud film, that come out of the Afro-American experience, they're not, or are they, encoded elements of blackness? I mean, could you identify a film that has those elements in it as a black film? I mean, is that something that, I guess I'm trying to get back at the aesthetic element. If that is something that one can take as, not as a legacy, but as a continuum from Oscar Michaud's work and relate it to, say, some contemporary, Spike Lee, for instance, do you see any parallels between?
one of the reasons I was bringing up music, literature, and whatever, I think that's the test. Can you run that characteristic through the cultural continuum? And does it also show up in contemporary film? I think it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, wait till it.
Okay.
Paddy Wagon goes by.
be careful about that, it's anti-Irish data.
Oh, sorry. I retract it. We'll edit that out of the tape. You want to repeat what you just said?
I know that you're attempting to establish an aesthetic, a cinematic aesthetic, but I think prior to that, if we're talking about blackness, encoding blackness, that whatever trait that is, can we trace it through all cultural practice? That's the test, which is why I keep bringing up magazines, poetry, music, or whatever. If it doesn't stand that test, then it's questionably black.
Also, too, I mean, because a lot of... It's hard to judge Michaud in some ways because so much of his work is fragmentary. And the other thing is, you know, film really was part of a whole presentation, and it's almost like... just having certain scenes of, you know, August Wilson's plays, or maybe even, I don't know, and trying to reconstruct it, or not even that, maybe just having film versions of certain scenes of August Wilson's play. I mean, you know, part of it was the music, part of it was the context, you know, the that you saw, you know, the of the entire film, and so it's hard to judge. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
does the audience help to define?
Absolutely.
The film?
One thing that, you know, the thing that in terms of subject matter that really always pokes its head out in these Michaud films is this color thing, mm-hmm. which it's really hard in 1992 to understand all of the intrigues of color, which are so central to these films made in the 20s. Not to say that there aren't color issues
yes.
in 1992, but mm-hmm. it's still...
What was the context? What were the feelings then? What was getting said then? What were the jokes
right. and,
about?
Right, and so much having to do with love, you know?
Yes.
I mean, love and color is so... They're so, you know, tied, you know, in the Michaud films.
Love and color. You want to expand on that a little bit?
In Symbol of the Unconquered, for example, Van Allen, the hero prospector, his reluctance to respond to Eve, the heroine's presence, her nearness,
mm-hmm.
Her obvious attraction to him, or certainly her trust of him,
yeah.
her comfort with him, and his holding back. Because he perceives her as white. And then 2 years later, when he, after reading the letter and he realizes she's black, then we wind down to the end of the movie, or what seems to be the end of the movie, with the iris out on the lovers.
Would you describe that kind of situation, which is frequent in Michaud films, that sort of identity,
mm-hmm.
discovery of true
mm-hmm.
identity. Would you describe that as some, I guess, critics of Michaud or some scholars